They will regulate militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, the first of 2026. So glad that you're with me. Hopefully you had a good New Year's Eve and the new year is treating you well so far. You know, boy, it's a good thing I took off what I did because, like, nothing eventful happened while I was gone, right? Right? Yeah, so we had Baird versus Bonta come down, the Ninth Circuit decision that declared California's ban on open carry, at least in the urban parts of the state, unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. Then, of course, you had the ouster of Nicolas Maduro, who is now facing, among other things, charges of machine gun possession. I will confess, I'm still a little confused about that, given that I don't think Maduro's charged with possessing a machine gun on U.S. soil. But the way I read the indictment, it's basically that Maduro is charged with possession of a machine gun in furtherance of a criminal enterprise against the United States. So I am not an attorney. I don't know if those charges are going to stick, those particular charges are going to stick. But another very interesting development and another case of the DOJ not just actively defending federal gun law, but actively using federal gun law to go after enemy of the United States in a criminal enterprise. And then we've got knife rights versus Bondi, which we had the government's reply brief filed last week. And the DOJ once again taking the position that a federal, now this time not a gun law, but a federal law dealing with arms is constitutionally compliant, even though this bans the interstate commerce in automatic knives, bans the possession of automatic knives on federal land. And automatic knives, in particular, I think, are arguably in common use for lawful purposes. But as you'll hear with Doug Ritter from KnifeRights.org, who's today's guest, the arguments raised by the DOJ in defense of the Federal Switchblade Act really open up a huge can of worms. And allow the gun control lobby a lot of material to work with, frankly, in terms of attacking our Second Amendment rights. Take a look and a listen. Doug, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Always a pleasure.
I wish the conversation were a little bit better topic. I wish we were talking about the DOJ siding with knife rights as opposed to siding with the current law regarding the Federal Switchblade Act. So if you can, give us a little bit of background on this lawsuit that knife rights has filed challenging the Federal Switchblade Law.
So the Federal Switchblade Act has been around since 1958. So we're talking almost 70 years.
Okay.
It was enacted as a reaction to some fake news. A hack journalist who started out with an article in one of the major women's magazines of the day, titled Toy That Kills. There was never any actual factual basis to any of the hysteria that grew out of that, and West Side Story and all the rest of Hollywood and Broadway hyperbole that occurred, and we ended up with this law that prohibited interstate commerce in switchblades, which, by the way, also includes gravity knives and butterfly knives, and also outright prohibited them on federal lands, which when you take it as a whole, ends up being about 30% of the entire United States.
Wow.
Where legally, supposedly, you can't carry a automatic knife. And that also included Indian lands, or what we now refer to as the Native American reservations. One of our plaintiffs is a Native American who lived in Arizona, had a switchblade, moved to Tulsa, significant part of Tulsa is actually on the Indian reservation. And he left his automatic knife with me because legally he couldn't possess it in his home in Tulsa. So he's one of our plaintiffs. We have retailer plaintiffs. We have individual plaintiffs, all of which either want to travel with their automatic knives that they already own legally in the state where they possess them, or want to possess them in a state where they can't get, theoretically can't get it. This is an insane law at this juncture. After Heller and Bruhn, this should be a slam dunk. But for reasons we don't quite understand, you know, on the day that the DOJ sues DC over their AR ban, they attempt to defend this unconstitutional federal ban on switchblades. It's pretty insane and absurd.
It is. And I mean, I think it's part and parcel of what we've seen from the DOJ aggressively going after state and local gun control laws while defending, in the vast majority of cases, actively defending federal statutes, not just regarding, you know, NFA items, but as you say, switchblades as well. What is the argument that the DOJ is using here to defend the Federal Switchblade Act?
So it's a bit insane.
Okay.
As you might expect. So basically, I mean, it boils down to a couple things, but the really insane part is they're claiming that these knives are more dangerous because they are concealable, which is true of every kind of knife,
mm-hmm.
and is also true of handguns,
mm-hmm.
And many other arms. I mean, the Second Amendment doesn't say firearms. It says arms.
Right.
They admit, essentially, that knives indeed are arms. And they're just saying, but, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't cover them because they're conceivable, because they're dangerous, because they're concealable. That's just crazy.
It is crazy. And, you know... So one of the things that we've seen with this DOJ is that the Civil Rights Division, I think, is taking the lead in litigating these state and local gun laws. And then you're seeing U.S. attorneys. They're not part of the Civil Rights Division. They're not part of the Second Amendment section. But you know, they may be part of the Civil Division defending things like, you know, the NFA and the Federal Switchblade Act, using arguments that, frankly, I'm not convinced the Civil Rights Division would go along with. Because, you know, going back to like the NFA cases, we've heard the DOJ argue that a $200 tax stamp is a modest burden on our Second Amendment rights, even though suppressors, they say, are protected by the Second Amendment. Registration, taxing them, that's not a big deal, right? Well, it is a big deal. And similarly, if the DOJ is going to argue that concealable arms are either less protected or completely unprotected by the Second Amendment, I mean, Doug, again, that opens up a huge can of worms, right? That argument can't just be limited, no matter how much the DOJ might want to structure it this way. It can't just be limited to switchblades, right?
Like these guys have not ever read Heller, Bruhn, Kitano. I mean, all of these Second Amendment litigation victories that have changed how the legal landscape is for arms. It's like, well, we're just going to make up stuff. We're going to make up stuff that makes no rational sense. I mean, a switchblade doesn't open any quicker than any other folding one hand open folding knife. It doesn't open. It certainly doesn't open quicker than a fixed blade, which is already open, if you will. It's certainly not more dangerous than a handgun, which can reach out and touch someone, you know, 15, 20, 25 yards away easily, something you're not going to accomplish with a knife. And they're common. They're simply another way to open a pocket knife. There's nothing unique or special about them in terms of their capability of being used for self-defense, or, as the DOJ would have us believe, because of their attributes, they lend themselves to criminal use. I mean, that's insane. It's just like a frivolous argument that where have they been for the last couple decades?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about that, because at the state level, knife rights has been, I think, hugely successful in getting some of these bans off the books, right?
Right. So when we started our state our legislative efforts in 2010, after the 2009 amendment to the Federal Switchblade Act that protected one-hand opening and assisted opening knives, there were 24 states that had some manner of restriction on switchblades. We're now down to 4 with absolute bans, and another dozen with some manner of restriction on length or carry or how you can carry. We've been hugely successful. I mean, a total of 53 bills in 33 states and 3 or 4 litigation victories. I mean, in Massachusetts, their state Supreme Court found that their restriction on the length of a switchblade was unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. I mean, we're talking Massachusetts here.
Right.
One of the issues is, in order to be banned, an arm must be both dangerous and uncommon, if you will. One way to show commonality is jurisdictional. Well, if you only have 4 states in the entire country that ban them absolutely, that makes them pretty common, to say nothing of the fact that the DOJ, back when this law was passed, the DOJ opposed this law because it said they were useful tools. So the DOJ opposed the law when it was being debated and eventually passed, but now 70 years later is trying to say, oh, they're pulling the arguments from the other side that these are more likely to be used by criminals and juvenile delinquents. And we know from the Senate reports of the time that over 1 million switchblades a year were being sold. So there's no question that they're common.
This right.
Mid-50s.
Yeah.
Mid to late 50s. These were common knives and still are today.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, is there, because the way the federal law is structured, right, this prohibits the interstate commerce in automatic knives, but presumably if a knife is manufactured in Arizona, an Arizonan is free and clear to purchase one without violating federal law, right? So do you have any idea, Doug, how many switchblades are legally owned right now in the United States? Even a rough estimate?
Well, so unlike firearms, which are easily tracked,
right,
because of all the regulations, we have no idea, but that's certainly in the millions. Mm-hmm. And if you correctly, and we believe appropriately, describe it as simply another folding knife, it's hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
I mean, pocket knives are all over. Not everybody, but certainly everyone you and I know has a pocket knife or two or three or four or five.
Yeah.
So they can't. The Second Amendment, the Bruen decision basically says, Heller and Bruen together, that if they are not both dangerous and uncommon, then you can't ban them.
Right.
Well, they're not more dangerous than other arms that are already legal and accepted, and they're certainly common. So where does the DOJ get off saying that the Second Amendment doesn't apply? Which is basically what they've said. Yeah, they're arms, but.
I mean, I'm looking at the DOJ's reply brief right now. And they talk about, you know, states have long prohibited the carrying of concealed weapons, and courts have long upheld the constitutionality of such prohibitions, which, again, I mean, even there, I think the DOJ is treading on some dangerous ground. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that the DOJ is right. That you could ban the concealed carrying of knives as long as you allow the open carrying, right, of knives, because, again, we've got the right to keep and bear arms, so you got to be able to bear them somehow. If you can't do it concealed, you got to be able to do it openly. Well, there's nothing inherently. I know they try to make a big case about, you know, automatic knives, the blades concealed. Okay, but that's true, as you say, for every pocket knife. I've got a little Opinel that I carry with me every day, just, you know, for, it's just a cheap little folding knife, but this is concealed. I keep it in my pocket. You never see it until I pull it out. So if that logic applies to switchblades, then it would apply to, as you say, gravity-assisted knives, little pocket knives that, you know, require you to open it up by hand. Those are just as concealable, right? And they may have a blade that's even longer than a switchblade, which would, I guess, make them more dangerous and unusual. It is a very weak argument, but it's also, again, a very dangerous argument, because, again, there is really no limiting principle in what the DOJ is laying out here, right? That if banning concealed weapons is permitted under the Second Amendment, then what is stopping the banning of handguns? Because they're in common use, is that it? So does it really boil down to how many automatic knives are out there? And again, if we have no way of knowing, how on earth is a court supposed to decide whether or not this law applies only to or this principle applies only to switchblades, not pocket knives, not gravity assisted knives, not butterfly knives, much less, you know, handguns I think are unquestionably in common use? It just takes us down a really dangerous road, I think.
Well, it's very dangerous. You know, when we started Knife Rights, one of our taglines was that we are the second front in the defense of the Second Amendment. And when we started, a lot of people scratched their head about that, because the Second Amendment to them only dealt with firearms. But as time has gone on, and as we have worked with the Second Amendment community, you know, our lawsuit in California, our lawsuit here, the appeals have received amicus briefs from all the major Second Amendment advocacy organizations and think tanks, because they recognize that an adverse finding in this case is going to adversely impact Second Amendment rights for firearms owners. This really has become a much bigger appeal than I think a lot of people thought it would, especially given the DOJ's position on things like concealability. This, you know, a finding in favor of the government in this case would be terrible for the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
And for firearms owners. Now, you know, do we think we're going to win in the end? I believe so. I certainly wouldn't have invested our limited resources in this if I thought we were going to lose. Litigation is a bit like rolling the dice. I mean, right. We don't know what 3-judge panel we're going to get. We're in the right district, but you just don't know. And the costs continue to escalate. Why? I mean, is the DOJ opposing this just because they are defending a federal law? And when they should be saying, yeah, you're right. Good possibility of that, but it is annoying and frustrating that we supposedly have a Trump administration that's in favor of Second Amendment rights. And this is about as clean and simple a 2A case as you can imagine. I mean, it's just that the issues are so clear, and yet they throw this pile of manure at us. And when I read that brief, I was like, oh my God. I mean, on the good side of it is it's a terrible defense, which makes our job easier, hopefully.
Right.
In our final brief. But it's just the issues they raise aren't just about knives. I mean, this is an important Second Amendment case.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, we just saw, Baird versus Bonta decided by the Ninth Circuit, I think on a Friday, right? Mm-hmm. The panel says California's ban on open carry in like 95% of the state violates the Constitution. There was a dissent in that opinion saying, oh, no, as long as you allow for concealed carry, you can ban open carry. You can have one or the other, but you don't have to have both. This brief is essentially the DOJ arguing that, yeah, states could ban concealed carry of arms in general without violating the Constitution, so long as they perhaps allow it to be openly carried, but not switchblades again, because those are inherently concealed, right? Because the blade is concealed. As you say, it's a bad argument. I mean, it falls apart when you just even try to follow the thread of logic. It falls apart, at least in terms of it being limited solely to switchblades. So I think that hopefully will work in your favor. But yeah, this absolutely has implications beyond automatic knives. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have seen Second Amendment groups respond so quickly and, so adamantly that the DOJ is wrong here. So this case is up on appeal to the Fifth Circuit. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Where are we now? This is the government's reply brief. So I guess we're still fairly early on in the appeals process.
Well, no, our final reply brief to their brief is due January 26th.
Okay.
And after that comes oral argument and then, a decision. So oral argument would probably be sometime this spring, mm-hmm. early spring. So it is well along the process. Does it mean that the DOJ couldn't come to their senses, as they have at least in part on other Fifth Circuit cases where they went, that brief we put in, how about we put in a new brief because we were really off base.
Yeah, with suppressors.
Yeah, so I mean, there's always that possibility. I'm not holding my breath.
Right. So, well, and even with Patterson, I mean, they came back in that new brief and said, okay, yes, we were wrong. Suppressors, we believe, are protected by the Second Amendment, but that's when.
But
you can still tax them. You can still require registration because that, again, just a modest burden. On the exercise of our Second Amendment right. And again, they try to play these games where, in the Patterson case, they basically suggested that there were, tiers of support for the Second Amendment, that maybe taxes and registration on handguns, no, that would be wrong, but taxes and registration on NFA items, that's okay. So, if they came back tomorrow and said, we've reconsidered our position here in knife rights versus Bondi, we believe that automatic knives are protected by the Second Amendment, but... they can still be restricted for reasons X, Y, or Z.
Well, that's what they've done. That's what they've done. That's exactly what they've done. They've admitted their arms. They admitted they are protected by the Second Amendment, except they really aren't.
Right. Because of the dangerous and unusual nature of automatic knives, right?
Yeah. And the fact that they're concealable. And that lends themselves to criminal use.
Yeah.
But by that logic, they could ban interstate trade in handguns.
Absolutely.
So it all falls apart. And maybe they want it. I mean, maybe they put this brief in so that it would be so terrible they lose. But they at least, you know, they did their job and defended the federal law. I don't know. It's so absurd. But it's frustrating because, of course, you know, now we're looking every step in these litigation processes are expensive. Mm-hmm. Lawyers are expensive. And this just raises the burden on a very tiny organization with limited resources that, like I said, I'm frustrated because it's we should not be here. If you read Trump's executive order, and if you read Bondi's comments and Dellen's comments on the founding of their Second Amendment Center, mm-hmm. they should be saying, "Yeah, this is not constitutional under the Second Amendment." I mean, everything.
Absolutely,
it's like speaking out of both sides of their mouth. It's like, yeah, but.
Part of President Trump's executive order required the Attorney General to not only look at, you know, the rules and regulations that were in place, but also the DOJ's position in litigation and whether or not it comported with the Second Amendment. So President Trump, I think, said, listen, you know, if the DOJ is taking a position that is contrary to our right to keep our arms, the DOJ needs to reverse that position. And we haven't seen that at the federal level. I don't know what is going on behind the scenes. I suspect that there is perhaps some internal conflict within the DOJ. When I interviewed Harmy Dillon, I think it was week before last, you know, she talked about how even a lot of the attorneys in the Civil Rights Division weren't Second Amendment supporters, you know, much less outside of the Civil Rights Division. And she talked about the need for more pro-Second Amendment attorneys to join the DOJ. And so I do wonder, again, whether there is an internal conflict here within the DOJ. And if there is, then honestly, it should be up to the Attorney General to resolve that conflict in favor of the Second Amendment and in accordance with the president's wishes. Whether or not that happens, beyond my pay grade, but that's what should happen.
But it's like good luck getting hold of those people at that higher level who could, you know, tell lower level DOJ attorneys, hey, look, this case is just crazy. You need to fix it.
Right.
I mean, I'm not sure how you managed to get an interview with Dillon, but I would love to get a one pager in front of her that basically says, you guys are so far off base here, you need to take another look at it. But my congressman has tried. He's not had any success. You would think at some level you could get the attention of these folks who are supposed to be protecting our Second Amendment and aren't really doing the job that the president told them to do.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating. I mean, there is no more clear-cut case currently in federal litigation than this case being unconstitutional. I mean, it is just so obviously unconstitutional. With the exception of the import ban, which Congress does indeed have authority to enact, the entire rest of the Federal Switchblade Act is unconstitutional. And clearly so. So why are we here? Yeah. At this point, having this conversation when we should be celebrating that, oh, the DOJ agreed and we're going to win this case and this stupid law is going to go away.
Well, as you say, it is frustrating. I hope we do get to celebrate one day, regardless of the DOJ's position at the moment here. And I do hope that the DOJ will reconsider his position in Knife Rights versus Bonding. But Douglas, I'd love to have you back once oral arguments have taken place in the Fifth Circuit so we can touch base and get an update, get your thoughts on how those oral arguments went. And then you said your reply brief to DOJ is due later this month. Is that right?
The 26th.
Okay. All right. Well, we will definitely be covering that at bearingarms.com. And Doug, thank you again for everything you're doing in defense and support of our Second Amendment. As you say, it's not just about firearms, right? It's the right to keep and bear arms. And that includes knives as well. So the second front in defense of our Second Amendment is kniferights.org. Thank you for everything you do and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Thanks so much, Cam. Thanks for having me on.
My thanks to Doug for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back here in a few weeks after the oral arguments take place. Hopefully take place in a very short period of time there in the Fifth Circuit. And, you know, before we get to our good deed of the day and our recidivist report and our armed citizen story, just, you know, again, to talk about the frustration that Doug and I think pretty much every Second Amendment supporter is feeling right now with the DOJ and the sort of split personality we've got going on where, you know, federal gun laws seem to be okay, state and local laws not so much. You know, again, I have no knowledge of the inner workings of the Department of Justice here, but ultimately, you know, the Attorney General is the one responsible for the positions of the DOJ. And if there is a conflict, I personally would like to see Attorney General Pam Bondi tell these U.S. attorneys, listen, you know, go read the president's executive order on protecting the Second Amendment. Keep that executive order in mind when determining what the position of the government should be in these particular cases. If that means that you don't believe the government can defend a particular law, then talk to your supervisor. Let's discuss this. And if you do believe that you can defend a federal law while remaining true to what the president said in his executive order about protecting the Second Amendment, you know what? You still probably talk to a higher up. Just get a second opinion here. But ultimately, I think that the administration right now is taking several positions that, again, are not just standing up for the status quo, but again, are using arguments that will provide a lot of aid and comfort to the gun control lobby going forward. And that is very concerning. Again, if you're making the argument that, hey, you know, concealable weapons can be prohibited without violating the Constitution, and then you try to, you know, have some sort of carve out for firearms and even, you know, knives with fixed blades. You know, those distinctions are really without a difference, right? You can fall back on that dangerous and unusual phrasing. But again, you know, what level of specificity are we talking about here in terms of an arms protection or an arms status is dangerous and unusual, right? Are we talking about knives in general? Are we talking about folding knives or a blade that, you know, retracts in some way, shape, or form versus a fixed blade? Are we talking about the mechanism by which a retractable blade is, you know, put in a locked position where it can be used? Because if we're going to get down to that level of specificity, right, then you're going to have gun control advocates say, okay, well, maybe revolvers are protected, right? But maybe semi-automatic firearms should not be considered protected, no matter how common they might be, because they are dangerous and unusual, right? They are they aid criminal activity because they can, you know, fire and reload more quickly than a revolver can or a bolt-action firearm. I just think, again, you go down a very dangerous road when you start adopting the arguments that the DOJ has adopted, both in the Peterson case dealing with, you know, suppressors. Second Amendment protects suppressors, but you can still tax them and register them because they're different somehow than handguns, or the position in Knife Rights versus Bondi, where, you know, yes, knives are protected by the Second Amendment, but automatic knives, not so much, because their inherent concealability means that they lack the protection provided by the Bill of Rights. I just, again, I think that that's just some dangerous positions to take in terms of safeguarding a right to keep and bear arms. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a tragic story out of Raleigh, North Carolina, where police say a man who broke into a home of a teacher and then murdered her has a lengthy criminal history. According to the Raleigh Police Department, a woman identified as a Zoe Welsh called 911 on Saturday at 6:30 in the morning to report that a man was inside her home. While she's on the phone with 911, the guy begins assaulting her. When officers got to the scene, they found Welsh with life-threatening injuries. She was taken to a hospital, and she later succumbed to those injuries. Police identified a 36-year-old named Ryan Camacho as the suspect. They've charged him with Welsh's murder as well as felony burglary. According to WRAL in Raleigh, Camacho has a, quote, lengthy criminal history going back more than a decade in both Wake and Durham counties. More than 20 arrests during that time period. In many of those cases, charged with either a misdemeanor or the cases were dropped altogether. He was arrested in 2021 after he escaped from a state prison in Salisbury, North Carolina. 2 years before that, so 2019, he had pleaded guilty to a shooting into occupied property. In December, so just last month, Camacho faced breaking and entering charges, but that case was dismissed after a mental competency evaluation. According to WRAL, during the hearing, prosecutors asked to have Camacho involuntarily committed, but that request was denied by a judge. So, I don't see, and this is, again, I don't get this. So he's not mentally competent to stand trial, but he can't be involuntarily committed because of his mental condition? No. That should not be allowed to happen. If somebody is mentally incapacitated to the point that they don't understand the charges against them, can't assist in their defense, again, are incompetent to stand trial, well, that seems to me to be a serious enough condition that they don't need to be out on the streets. And they do need to be in an inpatient setting until their condition improves. But to say, nope, too mentally ill to go to trial, not mentally ill enough to go to a psychiatric hospital, nope. That is a huge, huge problem. And I hope that we hear more about this judge. And I hope that we hear from North Carolina Republicans about fixing this loophole that exists. Because again, if you are too mentally incompetent to stand trial, you're not safe to be on the streets, in my opinion. WRAL says Camacho's criminal background now raising questions for Welsh's former students. Calissa Sauls, who was one of her former students, said, wasn't something done? This could have been prevented. She said, I've seen so many comments saying she's literally the sweetest. She had a great soul, and that's very much true. So to hear that she died in this horrific way, it's heartbreaking. Camacho is expected to make his first court appearance today. What happens if he's declared incompetent? Maybe now that somebody is dead, if that happens, he'll be confined to a mental institution. But you shouldn't have to wait for somebody to die for common sense to prevail, right? Now, today's Armed Citizen story from Savannah, Georgia, where police say a woman acted in self-defense during a shooting just a couple of days ago. And yeah, I'm aware of the parallels here, right? It was Friday. Police responded to a shots fired incident. Found a man leaving the area with a minor graze wound to his arm. Identified the man as Alvin Dubois. Dubois told officers he didn't know who shot him. He was treated at the scene by emergency medical services. Refused transport to a hospital. Witnesses, however, reported seeing Dubois assaulting a woman, who then fired a gun to stop the attack. Investigators determined that the woman and Dubois had previously been in a relationship. The woman actually called 911 to report the incident. Police concluded that the shooting was an act of self-defense. Dubois was arrested and charged with battery. The investigation remains ongoing. I am glad that this woman was able to protect herself. And again, I'm aware of the parallels to the previous story that we talked about. I'm not victim blaming. Nobody should be murdered in their own home, regardless of whether or not they're a gun owner. You deciding, for whatever reason, not to exercise your Second Amendment right should not amount to a death sentence. But I do wonder if Ms. Welsh was a gun owner. Did she have access to a firearm? Again, she called 911. She reported somebody in her house. The assault took place while she's on the phone with 911. I am assuming that she did not have access to a firearm. And again, owning a gun doesn't guarantee your survival. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to walk away from a violent encounter. It just doesn't. And if anybody tells you that, then they're lying to you. But I believe it does increase the odds of you being able to fight back. It does increase the odds of survival. And when somebody is threatening your life, when somebody is assaulting you to the point that, again, you are in legitimate fear of death or great bodily harm, you have the right to protect your life. I just think it's important that you have the ability to do so as well. Now, on to today's good deed of the day. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a anonymous Good Samaritan who came to the aid of a driver and an infant in the Houston, Texas area by kayaking to them after their car crashed into Dickinson Bayou. Again, the Good Samaritan wanted to remain anonymous. We don't have a ton of information, but happened in Dickinson, Texas, southeast of the Houston area. Happened Thursday night about 9:45. Officers responded after getting a call of a vehicle that had crashed into the bayou, but before officers got on the scene, a Good Samaritan used a kayak to paddle out to the submerged vehicle, rescue the driver, as well as an infant trapped inside that vehicle. Don't have a lot of information. Officers did conduct an investigation. They say alcohol and drugs not a factor in the crash. Both the driver and the infant were checked out by doctors. Both okay, no injuries. The Dickinson Police Department released a statement saying they'd like to thank the Good Samaritan for his quick and selfless actions. And yeah, I mean, listen, you know, 9:45 at night, it's dark out. Thankfully, you know, police were alerted to this crash because that very well might not have been the case either. But for somebody to be in that position where, and again, I know it's South Texas. It's not like, you know, they're hopping into the icy waters of Puget Sound or, you know, Baffin Bay or someplace like that. But still, you know, it's winter. It's cold. That Good Samaritan took it upon themselves to get out into the water to check out crash, and again, to help those in need. So, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We thank you, anonymous Good Samaritan there in Dickinson, Texas. That is going to do it for this edition of Variant Arms, Cam & Company, and I do want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow. But be sure to check out VariantArms.com. In the meantime, we are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation, including Tim Walz's announcement. He's not running for a third term as Minnesota governor, but it looks like the options for Democrats no better than Walz when it comes to the Second Amendment. We've got that story and a whole lot more for you at VariantArms.com. If you like what you see, but also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member, use the promo code FIGHT, and you can take 60% off your membership. You'll get all kinds of great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose, but we certainly do appreciate you supporting the work that we're doing here at Variant Arms. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow for 2A Tuesday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.